talks to negotiate a deal on government spending and federal debt are on pause. That news comes from the lead Republican negotiator, Louisiana Congressman Garrett Graves.
Now, just yesterday, the Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy and President Biden sounded upbeat about a deal for the U.S. to avoid defaulting on its loan payments. So, time for our politics roundtable. Margaret Tolliv is senior contributor at Axios. Hey, Margaret.
Hey, guys. Hi, Peter. How's Scott?
Hey.
And Francesca Chambers is White House correspondent for USA Today. Francesca, happy Friday.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So, Margaret, we're trying to get a sense of what's going on with these debt ceiling talks. Let's take a listen to House Speaker McCarthy yesterday.
Well, look, we're not there. We haven't agreed to anything yet, but I see the path that we could come to an agreement.
I see a path, and all along the idea of the path was to cut a deal with the White House on spending cuts and changes to safety net programs, and now they've paused. Margaret, what might be happening here?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question that we're all asking right now is how much of this is theater and how much of this is real? President Biden and Democrats have come right out and said, look, even if we're willing to have some discussions about some potential cuts as a matter of budget planning, we're not going to do anything consequential to shake up things like eligibility, right, for Medicaid or for food stamps or something like that. So that was always the starting point for the negotiations. And now there's this pause, this strategic pause. And the question is the pause going to derail anything, or is the pause the thing that Speaker McCarthy and his negotiator have to do to show the caucus, you know, that they're being tough? And the question on, I think, the White House side is the White House really as confused and bewildered as they sound like they are right now at this moment about what the pause is all about? Or do they have some room to move closer to a compromise also? But the backdrop to all of this is that the clock really is running down. And because of international summits this week, including the one that the president had to scrap in Australia, there is heightened global attention to this and just serious dismay and frustration over U.S. arrogance in other corners of the world, because what happens in the U.S. impacts many other countries, from Ukraine to Western allies.
Well, and not to mention Wall Street, where Jamie Dimon apparently has a war room to figure out what happens financially if this default happens. Just quickly, Margaret, Francesca, is it clear who walked away from the table here?
Well, it's not entirely clear what happened yet, but I will say that it was clear that something was happening when President Biden left early from a dinner that was taking place at the G7. The White House had said that it was to get a briefing on the debt ceiling, which struck an odd note because he had already had a briefing earlier in the day on the debt ceiling. So it seemed like, why is he having another briefing? So this could explain what was happening there. But I wanted to pick up on Margaret's point about other nations, you know, being so concerned. When you look at the G7, for instance, President Biden's currently in Japan. Japan is one of the largest foreign nations that holds U.S. debt. The U.K. is also right up there at the top of that list, too. And President Biden has made the point that other nations are concerned about the United States potentially defaulting on its debt. And earlier today, I was talking to the French ambassador to the United States, who told me that this is a source of stress for other nations and that it's a concern for the entire world.
So, exactly. And I know it's tough, but this June 1st deadline is coming up very quickly. Oh, in a word, from both of you, when the deadline hits, will we still be negotiating? Just quickly, both weigh in on that in a word, if you could.
I'm going to give you three words or so. I think it's entirely possible that everyone has to act outraged before they get to the deal.
Okay.
The deal could be a minute away, or we could pass June 1st and still be struggling. But I think it's entirely possible that they reach a deal in time or about in time.
That's certainly what the hope would still be. That is certainly what the hope would still be, is that they would be able to get something over the weekend.
All right. Well, let's shift gears here to Ron DeSantis, because next week we expect the Florida governor to announce that he is officially going to run for the Republican presidential nomination. The New York Times says DeSantis told donors that he's one of three candidates who can actually win this race. The others are Trump and Biden. Francesca, what do you think? What position is DeSantis going into this expected announcement next week?
He's going in a weakened position from where he was several months ago when he was running almost neck and neck with former President Trump. If you look at polling over the last few weeks, in some of these polls, Trump is 30, 40 points ahead of DeSantis now. DeSantis still in the double digits, which is more than you can say for the other individuals who are in the race or thinking about getting in the race in some cases. But he's certainly further below Trump. And the attacks that Trump and Trump's allies, the super PAC, have been making on DeSantis have been dragging down his polling. But DeSantis' allies do believe that once he gets into the race, that he will be able to counter those attacks more effectively on Trump.
Now, Ron DeSantis has gone to Iowa, I believe, more than once as he gets ready to announce. Today, he was in New Hampshire touting a new Florida law that would defund diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at Florida State universities. Let's take a listen.
These DEI consultants, they'll show up. Yeah, I would like to come and lecture about how capitalism is racist, only if you pay me $50,000 an hour. And I'm like, okay, come on. So our view is that DEI, really the way it's practiced, stands for discrimination, exclusion, and indoctrination. And that has no part in our public institutions.
Now, Margaret, this is a standard feature of the DeSantis playbook, the war on what he calls woke liberalism. Do you sense this is working politically? Because in the polls, he's not doing well compared to Donald Trump.
I think he's clearly playing to the base. That's not a great general election strategy, but in the base, DeSantis feels that it's necessary. And look at what his slogan is. Trump's is MAGA, right? DeSantis is, I don't know how to pronounce it, MAF. It's Make America Florida. So he's trying to position Florida as kind of the epicenter of the culture
math.
Wars. And
it's a confusing hat, too, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's going to stick.
No, this is very, very much on brand, I think, for the messaging to the base. And he is looking at the clock and he is thinking there are months ahead of primary season and months ahead for Fulton County to decide about a potential prosecution of Donald Trump. There are a lot of further chapters in the legal battle against Donald Trump. And Ron DeSantis's bet is that time is on his side.
Yeah. Francesca, let's give Republican Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina his due, because today he filed his papers for 2024. He's also raised a lot of money. What do you think his chances might be?
He has. And, you know, some of the Democrats I have talked to see him as one of the more formidable challengers if he were to make it out of the GOP primary against President Biden, because he is someone who they view as being able to bring in the African-American vote, and that's an area where President Biden isn't performing as well as Democrats and even, you know, the Biden campaign would like to see him at. You heard even the Biden campaign this week say that they'd like to expand on communities of color within their campaign. So certainly Tim Scott comes in to a race where, again, he is not polling as high as you'd want your candidate to be polling when you're entering a presidential race, but he certainly is sitting on a lot of money, and his advisors have said that he'll be going on the air with advertising and staying up on the air to help boost his name identification. They see it largely as a problem of identification and believe that when Senator Scott gets to know voters, or rather voters get to know him, that he will be able to persuade them of his candidacy.
Let's turn briefly to another senator, Dianne Feinstein. Tough story. A long-term Democratic senator from California is 89. She returned to the Senate this week after having the shingles, but it's now clear she was sicker than she acknowledged. We have sound of her this week talking to reporters, appearing confused.
What have I heard about what?
About your return. How have they felt about your return?
No, I haven't been gone.
Okay.
You should follow me. I haven't been gone. I've been working.
You've been working from home is what you're saying?
No, I've been here.
So the senator, I mean, she was away from the Senate and said, no, I haven't been gone. Margaret, how is Washington processing this? It's a very human moment in the Senate.
This is a tragic turn of events. So it turns out that not only did she have shingles, but she had some complications that are rare but related to shingles: encephalitis, swelling of the brain, some nerve pain around her eye. You can see it, but it's very rare for an office to come out and contradict the senator that the office represents. And that's what they've had to do now, just because she was saying she wasn't having these complications, and she was having these complications. I'd say a couple things. It is true that it's been a long tradition in American Senate history for male senators who are really old to overstay their time there when they're really having trouble functioning and remain on the job. Having said that, Dianne Feinstein is turning 90 next month, and she's been seriously compromised by her health struggles. So I think it is true that traditionally men have had a different, standard, but that doesn't make this easy. And there are questions about whether she can process information and make difficult decisions. Politico had a fascinating story about the fact that former Speaker Nancy Pelosi's daughter has been accompanying Dianne Feinstein through the halls.
Let's leave it right there. Margaret Talev with Axios and Francesca Chambers, USA Today. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.